This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Have you thrown anything in the trash today? Well, if you did, your garbage most likely went into a plastic bag. There's probably a good chance the price of that bag has increased in the last few weeks. The reason? Tariffs. Island Plastic Bags has been manufacturing the product for which it is named in Honolulu since the early 90s. Now, as part of our ongoing look at how local companies are being impacted by the ongoing trade war, HPR's Ryan Finnerty called Adrian Hong, the president of Island Plastic Bags.
The tariffs, they definitely hurt. So we make trash liners here locally. We also buy some trash liners from China, because we manufacture low-density trash liners. We buy high-density trash liners because it doesn't make sense to manufacture them locally. Nobody manufactures high-density here locally. Different equipment, different material. So bag manufacturers, they usually buy from each other just because of the fact that nobody produces everything, like Ziploc bags, pouches, this, that, the other thing. So we do buy a fair amount of products from China. And when it was 10%, the tariffs, it definitely hurt. I loaded up beforehand, you know, and then the tariff went in, and then we thought it was going to get resolved. So we're like, okay, we'll buy another container, and then we'll buy another container after that. But we're still eating that 10%, and it's still hurting our bottom line, making it very difficult to make money. Luckily, during that time, we were also looking at other sources from other countries, Vietnam, Malaysia, places like that, just in case. And, you know, we had just started buying the first container from Vietnam. You know, we had tried out the bags, tried out the quality, and we bought the first container when we heard about the tariffs increasing to 25%. So we're moving in the direction of moving away from buying from China, just because there's no way we can eat 25%. There's no way that our customers are going to accept a 25% increase in their price. So, yeah, it's been very painful for us because, you know, we held on for a while during the 10% tariffs, just hoping that, because there's a lot of noise from both sides, China and America, that, you know, they're close to resolution. So, like, you know, we'll stay with our, because we've been working with our Chinese manufacturers for over 10 years, and we don't want a manufacturing partner, so we don't want to move away from them if we don't have to change our supply, you know, change our suppliers, the quality of the product that we've been bringing in. You know, you never know when you start moving to new people what's going to happen logistically, with quality, with timing, with everything. And, you know, we're pretty loyal in terms of when we get a good supplier, we stay with them. So we didn't want to move away, but we started having to look just because we were afraid of this fact that this was going to go on forever. And luckily, we already started the process of, you know, starting to move away from China and stuff like that. But it definitely hurts because, you know, you have to change up your logistics where you're buying it stuff, your freight companies. You have to stock new products, get customers on board. And there's some places and people, they can't get products easily from another country. Like, you know, it wasn't terrible for us to go and find another source in another country, whereas other people, when you're looking at, like, machine parts for certain things that are made in China, things like that, they're going to eat that 25%. And a lot of people really don't understand that you may be buying a machine or a product from a U.S. company, but it probably has a lot of components that come from China or that are assembled in China or all kinds of stuff, you know. So, you know, I talked to some of my customers, and, you know, they're seeing price increases on things that they buy from U.S. manufacturers, but they had no idea that it had components that come from China. So, yeah, it's definitely a big impact. And 25% is not something that companies can just absorb.
So were you absorbing that 10% as just a hit to your bottom line, or did you consider a price increase at all to offset it?
So we ate it for a while, and then it started to extend a little bit longer. So we did do a price increase, not the full 10%, but we did do a price increase. Because increasing your pricing, then you start, you know, there's possibility of losing market share and stuff like that because people are bringing in from other places. You're less competitive on the pricing and stuff like that. We were looking at other places to kind of supply us with same quality or similar quality and better pricing.
Now, I know the Commerce Department was granting limited exemptions for companies that didn't have a domestic source or a viable alternative other than China. Was that something that you explored at all?
I didn't. I heard about that, but I didn't really explore it. You know, we're a small business. We got like 15 people total, 14 people total. I didn't think I had the resources to kind of figure out how to figure out the exemption, claim for it, provide evidence and stuff like that. I didn't know what the process was. And there are U.S. manufacturers that make trash liners, high-density trash liners that we buy and stuff like that. They're just more expensive, especially when you're freighting them to Hawaii and you've got to pay, because the U.S. The Jones Act, you have to pay more on the U.S. freight from U.S. port to U.S. port than you can pay from China to the U.S. or Vietnam to the U.S.
What were your conversations like with your Chinese counterparts, your suppliers in China, as you were trying to make it work with them and then eventually having to switch and go to a buyer in a different country?
It's still ongoing because we don't know if it's going to be resolved. So we're not slamming the door in anybody's face. But, you know, it's definitely a difficult conversation to have in terms of, we have to look. You know, we've been dealing together for a while now, but I have to go start looking at, you know, other sources.
And what did you hear from your suppliers in China? Did they give you any insight as to what the discussions were like on that side of the Pacific?
So, I mean, our specific Chinese manufacturer was setting up a plant in Malaysia and stuff like that, but, you know, that, you know, it was just starting up, so it was a little bit more expensive running from that place than it would have been out of China with no tariffs. The minimums were higher and stuff like that, so it didn't work out as well for us. But they are also starting to look at moving their manufacturing to other countries as well.
Could you talk to me a little bit about the uncertainty surrounding this whole situation and how that has affected your business decisions and maybe the decisions of some of the people you work with?
Definitely. That's the biggest thing, is that the uncertainty. Because if we know that like a 5%, 10%, 25% tariff is coming in 6 months, 3 months, you can order more containers, you can stock more, you can start preparing by looking at other vendors. There's time to prepare. But when you hear, you know, on Monday that on Friday, you know, you're going from 10% to 25%, it's very difficult for companies to change. Because, like, if you're getting something from China, you're ordering 3 months out. You know, it's like a month lead time just for shipping, right? And then you've got manufacturing time as well, so 1 or 2 months on top of that. So because you've got so much lead time, you can't stop the ball rolling that quickly. So you're eating those tariffs when the president gives you only like 1 week notice. That's very painful. You know, and even the one in September, he didn't give people a whole lot of time to plan. You know, he just said, you know, the tariffs are coming, we're going to put this much on it, and there wasn't a whole lot of prep work you can do. And then, okay, so there's 10% now, deal might be coming soon, I hear good things from both sides that deal's coming soon, I'll just order another container, eat it this time, order another container, eat it this time, thinking that very soon there'll be a deal, when I could have been moving my line sooner than that. You know, so there, you know, you're accruing costs because you don't know what's going to happen. You're staying with your vendor now because you don't know if everything's going to be resolved. You don't want to move all your logistics, you know, buy from new people, take a new chance on products that you haven't been buying for the last 10 years, but your customers will accept them. So the uncertainty hurts a lot because you're staying with people when you can be moving earlier, but you don't want to change all your logistics, change all your product packaging, do all this work. If you don't have to. So, yeah, the uncertainty is probably the most painful part of it.
What would you say to the president if you got a phone call with him?
interesting question. I would say that tariffs are probably not the best route, especially such broad tariffs are not probably the best tool to accomplish his goals. I think that President Trump and, you know, the U.S. in general, both businesses and the government, have very legitimate concerns about the way China does business, stealing intellectual property, forced transfers, the ownership of joint ventures and stuff like that, access to certain markets. Of course, state subsidies is a big thing that certain sectors get from the Chinese government, and, you know, a lot of businesses complain about that. So there are definitely legitimate concerns that need to be addressed. I don't know if a 25% tariff on all trade from China really accomplishes that goal. And there are probably other ways of doing it that aren't as harmful to farmers, to other businesses, and consumers. I think that was a very blunt tool to use for a very complicated problem. I definitely probably would have gone and worked with our allies more, you know, worked with the European Union, worked with other countries to approach China, because they have the same concerns we do. I mean, we're not the only ones that have the concerns about the way the Chinese government, Chinese businesses do business, and confronted them together and worked on a plan together, you know, and, you know, maybe targeted certain industries where the concerns are and stuff like that, but broad 25% tariff across the whole spectrum and worrying more about the trade deficit rather than more of the structural problems like state subsidies and intellectual property theft, I think is the wrong approach.
Adrian Hong, thanks for your time today.
Yeah, thank you for giving me a chance to share my thoughts.
Adrian Hong is the president of Honolulu-based Island Plastic Bags. You can find this story and others on the local impacts of the tariffs on hawaiipublicradio.org. The man who's been at the helm of Queen's Health Systems for 3 decades will be stepping away from a job that some describe as his passion. Art Ushijima will be retiring as president and chief executive officer come January. We sat down with him yesterday to talk about what he's proudest of.
This year, in fact, we celebrate the 160th founding of the Queen's Hospital. And over the years, you know, Queen's has certainly grown and all. And there's certainly times in its history it's sort of lost its way. And 30 years ago, when Kenny Brown was the board chair, he embarked upon really focusing on the mission. And I embrace the mission. I believe in the mission and what it is about. And really, if there's any one thing I'm proudest of, or there are many things I'm proud of, but if I have to pick one thing, it would be that the organization is clearly focused on its mission, which is to fulfill the intent of Queen Emma and King Kamehameha IV. To provide in perpetuity quality health care services to improve the well-being of Native Hawaiians and all the people of Hawaii. It's a very simple statement, but it's a very challenging mission statement to execute. But it's something that I think the organization has done. And whatever we've done, we said, look, does it fit the mission first? And if it does, then what do we do to make the business case so that we can, in fact, make it a viable and actionable initiative? And so we've applied that, and it's taken... You know, I didn't think it's been a journey and continues to be a journey. But I think that our staff, you know, and what I'm proudest of is that it's reflected in the work of our staff. And as you said, your husband had the experience at Queen's, and you said that it was reflected in how the staff cared for him.
Yes, and he was impressed because you had little cards in mm-hmm. different languages. You know, as a sign to say, hey, you're welcome here. What can we do to help serve you and keep you well?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's there are a number of initiatives that we've implemented to operationalize the mission statement. And we've implemented a program called the Queen Emma Way, which is really about how would the Queen provide the care, provide the service, how would she do things, and how we're reflecting her wishes and her values.
And you have the extra challenge because you are there in the urban core in Kaka'ako, which is projected to grow by some 30,000 residents. We also have the challenge of the homeless and the mentally ill. And, you know, I saw how your staff really was just the demands that are placed on the staff is just incredible.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we've continued to grow, although the volume has been more in the ambulatory, the outpatient arena. And that's really the direction of change in healthcare today, is to try to provide more and more healthcare services. And across the enterprise, across the system, there's probably about 2 million outpatient visits already annually. But the particular challenge in the urban core, as you just mentioned, you know, there's certainly the demand of the new high-rises that are being built that we're there to support. But we also, as you know, have seen the growing issue of homelessness. And Queens provides 66% of the homeless care in the state, both at Punchbowl and at West Oahu. And so the cost to Queens is about $40 million a year, of which $11 million or about $12 million are unreimbursed. So our challenge is to provide the support of these individuals who need care. And the homeless patients are just as important in terms of the medical need as anyone else. And they're individuals who need care. And, of course, consistent with our values is that we will provide the care that they need, along with everyone else. And we're also investing heavily in new programs, whether it's in stroke care or whether it's in cardiac care or cancer. We've made affiliations, established affiliations with the MD Anderson Cancer Center. So we now have access to their expertise and working with them. Of course, we work with the UH Cancer Center as well. And so we've invested in these clinical programs to really provide the people of Hawaii the kind of care that they need, because most cannot go to the mainland to get care. And so we've invested in those programs. We've extended our reach, West Oahu, North Hawaii, and, of course, Molokai. And we feel those are the markets that we're serving and will continue to serve. And if we need it elsewhere, we'll continue to do that. By the way, Queens has 70 locations throughout the state, as well as in Guam and Saipan. So we have Diagnostic Laboratory Services, which is a joint venture with Kuakini Health System in Queens. So we provide clinical laboratory services in Guam and Saipan.
I guess looking back from the outside, looking in as mm-hmm. a journalist covering all the events in our community over the last 30 years, we've seen the expectation grow. We had the big APEC conference here. We had the SARS outbreak in Asia. And then just to be able to see how Queens has kind of situated itself to be able to rise up to the expectations when whether it's a anthrax scare mm-hmm. or whatever, that Queens is there, as a trauma center to respond to all these things that could happen.
As the tertiary coronary care center, the trauma center, of course, having the busiest emergency rooms in the state, clearly expectations have been placed upon Queens, and we have excellent physicians and nurses, great expertise among our team. And as issues come up, whether it's SARS, as you mentioned, Ebola is an issue, we're seeing certainly with the world becoming smaller by virtue of jet travel, that we're also seeing the incidence of significant emerging infectious disease arise. So it becomes important for us as Queens to support those efforts, but also to work with other healthcare providers, and, of course, the State Department of Health, which is an important resource for us. And so we have our team of folks, of professionals, very diligently, working to monitor the issues that confront this community.
What do you think about the doctor shortage that we're facing?
The medical school in Hawaii can't produce enough physicians, but it's still trying to do that. It's about 66 physicians in each medical students in each class. But the physician shortage is going to continue to grow. The fastest growing part of the population in this country is 85 and over. And so as we all get older, and like me, we're all going to be faced with increased healthcare demands. And so we work very closely with the medical school and with the dean, Dr. Jairus Hedges, and really trying to form partnerships and how we're going to develop the physician services that we need, but also non-physician professionals who also need it, such as nurse practitioners and advanced practice nurses and other healthcare professionals that are needed, because there won't be enough physicians to meet all the demand that's out there. And so the medical school plays a very key part, and the university plays a key part of our mission and working with them in a collaboration, along with the other hospitals that are involved in the training programs. One of the things that we did about 6 or 7 years ago was we knew that there was going to be a shortage of cardiologists. We projected that. And the chief of cardiology at that time, Dr. Rob Hong, led the effort to establish a cardiology fellowship. So now we have, I think, three fellows that are graduating every year. I think the goal is to get four fellows every year. So it's a three-year fellowship. So we're graduating about three or four fellows every year in cardiology, and we're actually meeting the need for cardiology as a result. So those are things that we're working at. We're working closely with Dr. Hedges as the dean of the medical school, Dr. Larry Shapiro, who heads the faculty practice plan, and our staff, in looking at how we can build a stronger training program for physicians.
And this year was also, I think, a milestone for transplant operations.
In terms of transplants, so that was an amazing, amazing part of something that we undertook. While we expected that Hawaii Medical Center West would close, we didn't know when. But we had staff, we did a feasibility study. And, of course, we couldn't take over the transplant program until it closed. And once it did, it was in December of 2011. By that time, we'd completed feasibility. And we estimated that over a five-year period of time, it would cost $40 million, and we would expect it to lose $5 to $7 million over the period of time. But there are 400 people in Hawaii on the transplant list, and about 1,500 transplantees, all needing support. So when the program closed, our board unanimously supported us taking on the transplant program. We submitted an application to UNIS, National Organ Sharing, or whatever. I forgot the acronym, but it's called UNIS. Anyway, they're the approving body, the accrediting body. And we submitted an application. It was like a 1,000-page application, and they approved it immediately. And we're able to do the first organ transplant in after the program closed. So it was closed in December. At the end of February of the following year, we did the first organ transplant. It was a liver transplant program of patient. And so UNIS had the fastest approval, and we had a program, you know. And the reason that we were able to do the transplant, because we wanted to keep the surgeons who did the transplant, but we also hired the staff who were doing the transplant at Hawaii Medical Center. So the key resources we were able to retain because we acted quickly. And what's really impressive is that the state legislature, knowing that we would incur this cost, they appropriated, without us asking, an emergency appropriation of $1.5 million, which helped to underwrite some of our startup costs. And so today we're doing roughly 80 transplants a year. Since the program was started in 2012, or restarted at Queens in 2012, we've done over 420 organ transplants to date. So we're able to support these patients who now don't need to go to the mainland. And for those who've had transplants, they can get the immunosuppression support, you know, through the transplant clinic that we have at Queens.
Is there any one particular story that you could share with us? Maybe a patient who was seen at Queens, or you know, something that, or a personal experience that you had with anybody there?
Gosh. You know, there are so many amazing stories, you know, that go on every single day that I don't know all of them. I get a lot of letters from patients. You know, I get more letters of compliments than I do complaints. That tells you the nature of the service and the care that our team provides. I mean, they do terrific work. And I'm really proud of our organization and our people. But one day, I was in the emergency room, and one of the physicians said to me, introduced me to one of the staff. He said, you know, there's this patient that came in, and he was a homeless patient, and one of our frequent users. And the nurse who attended him said, you know, Mr. Yamanaka, I'll just use it as a... He said, Mr. Yamanaka, do you realize that today's your birthday? Of course, this is a homeless patient. And he said, so of course he didn't. One day's the same as the next, right? And so she went out to the vending machine, got a cupcake, brought it back to the exam room where the patient brought some of her teammates. You know, they sang happy birthday. Oh, she got a candle, put it in there, and sang happy birthday to him. Thank God she didn't burn the emergency room down. But anyway, but the patient, you know, according to the physician who was there, was just overwhelmed because nobody recognized him. Right, as a patient, but as an individual who really deserved to be recognized as a human being. But that tells you the nature of the staff that we have who really care about people in a very genuine way. And that's how I see them translating the mission. And it goes on every day. There are thousands of these kinds of stories that occur every year, you know, throughout the enterprise at Queens. And I don't hear about every one of them. But when I do, I'm just particularly proud of our staff that do that. You know, we went through what's called the Magnet Survey, which is a national recognition by the American Nurses Credentialing Center. We just completed last week. And the surveyors, there are three of them, they're all nurses. And it's a recognition program that basically says it's, you know, you if you are designated, you're providing superb, excellent nursing care. And they all said that the mission and the values of our founders are alive in our staff. And they've never seen anything like it in any other hospitals that they've been to. And they do surveys across the country. And they all represent excellent hospitals as well. And so we get validation, you know, of how people live the mission every day.
Queen's Hospital was created by Queen Emma and King Kamehameha IV in 1859. Art Ushijima says there are so many things he will miss when he leaves, as the job has kind of gotten under his skin. He will be helping Queen's transition under a new CEO, Jill Hoggard Green, who started out as a registered nurse and comes from Mission Hospital and Mission Health in North Carolina, starts later this year. Ushijima tells us with all his free time, he plans to travel with his wife next year to celebrate their 50th wedding anniversary, and on his bucket list, a trip to New York to catch a few Broadway shows that he hasn't had much time for over the last 30 years.
Coming Saturday, June 8th to HPR's Atherton Studio. Hear songs of protest and revolution as Oahu native Peter Apo performs. Hear classic folk songs as well as Apo's own compositions. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Amoresco.
How many times must a man look up before?
Our reality check today looks at the final story in an investigative series on a secretive fisheries fund. Honolulu Civil Beats editor Patty Epler is on the line today. Good morning, Patty.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. So I was really interested in this final story because of the Ahumoku system. So explain to our listeners what you found out in this final story.
So the series that we've been doing looks at WESPAC, which is the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, which is a federal agency made up of various council members from all over the Micronesian region, as well as Hawaii, American Samoa. And, you know, their job is to manage fisheries, commercial fishing, basically, in the exclusive economic zone, the 200-mile offshore areas. So today's story in particular looks at the Ahumoku process, as you're mentioning, and how WESPAC, a federal agency, came to be involved in what is actually really a state fisheries management issue. And so back in 2006, when all of that was going on, WESPAC spent a lot of money bringing people to meetings and testifying and trying to get that whole process in place. It's happening again, or it was happening again, now over other state fisheries issues, bottom fish and that kind of thing. So Suzanne Case, who is the director of the Department of Land and Natural Resources, wants to know, why is WESPAC, you know, sort of inserting itself into this very state issue and kind of messing around in state fisheries policy? And even though she is a member of WESPAC as the state representative on the council, even she can't get the WESPAC executive director, Kitty Simons, to tell her what's going on with it.
Right, because at first blush you think, okay, but then when you start to look at it and you wonder about the influence on these councils, it's an intriguing issue.
It definitely is an intriguing issue because, you know, Suzanne Case is the first to say that the Ahumoku process actually has worked very well for the state, and it really gives them good input and good insight at the very local level about, you know, fisheries practices based on sort of generations of Native Hawaiian practices. But what she's concerned about is that there's something bigger afoot here, such as, is WESPAC trying to manipulate the process in order to open up the nearshore areas for these commercial fishermen that are, you know, kind of being shut out a little bit as the Marine National Monuments expand and that kind of thing. But because WESPAC is so opaque and closed about its financial records and its spending, it's very, very difficult to figure out how much money has been spent, what's it going to, what's it paying for, is it paying for people to actually give testimony and lobby? I think that's one of the big concerns.
Right, and that a voice about the transparency, I mean, that's being echoed by our congressional delegation in wanting to know more.
Yes, Senator Schatz, Congressman Case, Congressman Sablon from the Northern Mariana Islands is they're very concerned that fisheries policy is not being administered in the way that they believe Congress and the law intends it to be, which is for sustainability and conservation and not for exploitation of the resource to benefit the commercial fishing fleet.
And your story kind of gives a shout out to Environment Hawaii, a watchdog that has been around looking at the Westpac Council for some time.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think Pat Tubman started Environment Hawaii, which is a nonprofit, subscription-only sort of newsletter. I think she started that thing maybe 30, 40 years ago, and she started covering Westpac 25 years ago. And really, Environment Hawaii, with Pat and Teresa Dawson, who's the reporter here on Oahu, they've been covering that thing like a blanket almost, as we would say, for so long. And they've been stymied at every turn when they ask for public records, budget information, spending information. They've covered a lot that has to do with the sort of what would seem to be extravagant spending that Westpac spends for council meetings on Maui or council meetings on the Big Island, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars going to put on a meeting. So,
well, hopefully we can get some answers. But thanks so much for the report.
Oh, you're welcome. Happy to do it. Glad to be here.
All right. That was editor and general manager Patty Epler with today's Reality Check. To read the entire series, head to civilbeat.org. Every vote really does count. Our recent neighborhood board elections here on Oahu produced four ties, which were broken by a lottery. In a few cases, some incumbents were unseated by a single vote. And guess what? There are still some 29 vacancies spread out across the 33 boards, so it's not too late to get a spot. Now, Neighborhood Board Secretary Sean Hamamoto talked to us this morning about the election process.
We did show improvement in three areas. Number one is we did show an increase in candidates this year. In fact, we had the second highest amount of candidates in recorded history. Two is we had a significant increase in contested races. Back in 2017, we only had about 45 contested races. This time we had 63. So we were very happy about that. And we also showed gains in overall percentage of voters. Our return rate in voters this year was the highest ever since voting went online back in 2009. So it was a bit over 10%, whereas 2 years ago it was, you know, a bit under 10%. Now, the one stat that went down, and there's a caveat to that, is the total amount of votes that actually came in. Which was lower. This year, we got about 18,000. 2 years ago, we got about 21,000. But that's a very skewed statistic for the fact that you have to understand that for some reason, although we had a growth in participation, the way it grew in certain areas, if there's not a contested race, we don't send out ballots, you know, to save money. So just for some reason, we had certain areas, big areas, Mililani, all of Mililani, Kalihi Valley, parts of Hawaii Kai, big voting areas that we had candidates, but not enough for a contested race. Therefore, no ballots sent out. Therefore, no return. So that's the reason for the lower return rate. But the percentage rate was up. We had a higher percentage rate of returns this year. Whoever, like, for example, Kalihi Palama, there were only 13 seats available, and we had perfectly 13 candidates. And some of them were new, so some of the newcomers got on. So in cases like that, no ballots were sent out. But that's an interesting point. Now, this point was brought up at our commission meeting a few weeks ago as, you know, how to increase participation. So you know, an idea I brought to the table that was discussed was, even with the non-contested races, to have ballots sent out because we can decide the chair pro tem by the highest number of votes. Because currently the way the plan is written now, the chair pro tem is decided by whoever was chair last and something like that. But if we were to do it this way, I think it's a more accurate reflection of democracy.
Talk about the ties.
Okay, sure. So, you know, goes to show you every vote counts. We had four ties. And we settled that according to the plan. This is how we decide ties. If there's a tie, then that triggers a recount. So in these four cases, we did do a recount, and we confirmed that they were indeed ties. The next step is to just draw by lot.
So you did that this week.
We did that this past Monday at our office. We publicly announced it. We invited the candidates to come in. We did have a couple come in, and we just drew the lots. You know, out of name out of a bag.
So describe the process to our listeners.
Yeah, so basically they would come in. We would have a bag that you cannot see through. We would have their names printed on sheets of paper, which we would show everybody. We would then proceed to crumple the names into paper balls, put them in the bag, close the bag, shake them up. I would turn my head away, stick my hand in, mix it up one last time, and just draw the first thing that touched my hand, and that was the winner.
Okay, yeah. So then all those seats or those contests are decided based on the lottery.
Yes, they are decided. You know, all vacancies are listed on board meeting agendas. So if anyone's interested, the best way to do it is to go to your board meeting, go there in person. When that item on the agenda comes up, raise your hand and, you know,
and
introduce
volunteer.
Yourself, volunteer. And more often than not, with board approval, they'll bring you on. And more often than not, they're happy to have you.
So the deadline for contesting the results is this week. A swearing-in ceremony for the candidates is set for June 29th at the Blaisdell. Family and friends are welcome. For links to the results and more information about the process, head to hawaiipublicradio.org. Can you distill your life story in 6 words? Well, HPR's Noe Tanigawa showcases a new show on Maui that challenges you to do just that.
Exactly. It turns out to be a lot of fun. A lot of people have been doing this, Catherine. It's all happening at Hui No Eau. I don't know if you've ever been up there. It's a 501c3 nonprofit up in upcountry Maui. They have classes and workshops and shows and really state-of-the-art facilities there for glass, jewelry, printmaking. Even they've had some terrific printmakers up there over the years. Hui No Eau is up in a historic home and estate. It's some 25 acres there in Makawao, right off Baldwin Avenue. According to Jenny Pickett, who's the development and marketing officer there, the historic house was built in 1917. It's a Dickey home.
Neat.
Yeah, okay, so he grew up right over there, right there in Haiku, and of course was a Seminole architect here in Hawaii. He designed the home for Harry and Ethel Baldwin, and this is the Harry Baldwin. His father and uncle started Alexander and Baldwin. He was a plantation manager and a congressional delegate. His wife, Ethel Baldwin, was kind of an Eleanor Roosevelt type, you know. She led the Maui women's suffrage movement. She worked for child welfare laws and old age pensions on Maui. And Pickett says that Mrs. Baldwin also was really into the arts.
One of the things that she did was got a little hui of women together that were really interested in arts. And so they began meeting, I think, in the 30s, I want to say. Yeah, so we've just been keeping the hui alive ever since then. Our campus is filled with youth right now, which is really fun. We have Camp Kalua Nui that's going on because we believe that it's really important for youth to be able to access visual arts. You know, it can change and shape a whole entire community.
Really?
I'm just stoked to be able to work here. It's the most amazing place.
It's beautiful up there. I mean, in pictures, it's kind of imposing looking. Have you ever seen a picture of it?
Yes, I went online this morning to check it out. I haven't been, but I want to go.
Yeah, it's giant, and it's got those five arches down below and big French windows up above. And, you know, but I don't remember it that way. driving up, I remember the trees, and walking in, you just get that spacious, gracious feeling, you know, that you get when a breeze blows through an island home. It was crazy. It really beautiful in the old style. And everybody's always welcome to stop by. They're open daily, 9 till 4. And here's a good reason to stop by. It is that six-word memoirs juried art exhibition that's opening up on Friday. So what the heck is a six-word memoir, right? Here's the legend. Ernest Hemingway was challenged to write a story in only six words. Here's his story. For sale. Baby shoes. Never worn. Yeah. Okay. Well, in November 2006, Larry Smith of Smith Magazine gave this prompt to his readers. He said, "Can you tell your life story in six words?" And, I mean, ever since then, they've just been going crazy online. Smith Magazine's published more than a million life stories. The whole thing's global. There are books and blogs and entire websites about it. But this is the first time that Hui Noyao knows of that six-word memoirs have been paired with visual arts. And the jurors were David Peterson, professor of art and endowed chair at Skidmore College in New York, and Todd Van Amberg, who teaches English and drama at Seabury Hall. He also teaches creative writing at UH Maui. So it was cool. I got to talk with Van Amberg, who explains.
I mean, there's a fun quote by William Faulkner. He said that a novelist is a failed short story writer, and a short story writer is a failed poet. And I think that works really well for explaining that the six-word story is really a poem.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's very much like a haiku. Or as the author Sherman Alexie says, it's kind of like stand-up. You have a punchline at the end. You have a setup, a reaction, and a punchline. This one is a serious one by Robert Olin Butler, the author, Vietnam vet. It's called In Country. Saigon Hotel, decades later, he weeps.
Yeah. Well, the attraction is that it's just seen as a simple, creative way to get to the essence of something. And people use this now in, you know, teen groups where they get together as an icebreaker, and they just use it in different ways. Here's another one. He mentioned Sherman Alexie. Here's one by Alexie. My ex-wife, my brother, they eloped.
Oh,
okay.
Soap opera, yes.
Yep, exactly. Well, for this show now, artists were asked to submit artworks that somehow incorporated their memoir, and they got about 70 submissions, paintings, mixed media, all kinds of things. And, of course, I asked for some examples of successful works. Amberg, smarty pants. He refused, saying that would be giving it away. Okay? He says there's a lot of humor in the works that are there. He gave other examples as well, but just wanted you to know that in 2005, the people, that is the Hui in Hui Noyao, did buy the Baldwin property to preserve it as an art center and community resource. It exists today through grants and donations. And this show, Six Word Memoirs, opens this coming Friday. Everybody's invited to the reception. It's 5 until 7 o'clock up there at the Hui Noyao.
I love the idea of mixing the two.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you always hear, oh, a picture's worth 1,000 words, and you distill it, and you distill it, and you distill it, and then give me an image.
I know, exactly. And these people had great fun, I think, putting it together. Look, here's one of those six-word memoirs, A Modern Romance by Louise Farmer Smith. Facebook. Tweeting, texting, meeting, handshake, fleeing.
Like that.
Well, it kind of makes you want to go and write one yourself, right? How do you sum up your life in six words?
Yes. Oh, now I want to go to Maui. Either that or I hope this comes to Oahu.
Maybe. We'll have to start around those here.
Yes, there you go. I like that. All right. Thanks so much, Noe. That was HPR's arts and culture reporter, Noe Tanigawa. You can find her reports online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
This Week in This American Life, LaDonna works security at an airport, a job she really loved, except for her supervisors, who did some pretty bad stuff. But LaDonna, she does not accept the world as it is. She reads a lot of businessy, self-help, lean-in kinds of books, and so she decides to put them to work to fix her situation. How that goes for her this week.
Saturday afternoon at 1.
June 6 is the anniversary of D-Day, the invasion of Normandy by Allied forces. On a visit there last year, we ran into a French resident who lays flowers, fresh flowers, for a Waimanalo family of a soldier buried there. The brief encounter at the cemetery followed a visit by members of Halau Mele and Halau Hula o Manoa as part of the French Hawaii Festival. In a nod to the memorial services marking the importance of our ties to our European neighbors, we're broadcasting a story that we ran last summer following that visit. Take a listen. The sounds of bells peal from the Ermenville Church Tower throughout the day in this little town. It's where the BBC first broadcast to the world following D-Day and the liberation of France from German occupation.
To let you know that the people of Normandy are celebrating their liberation. The church bells are ringing, and the villagers are going to mass to give thanks for their freedom.
And it was at the Ermenville Cemetery, the British cemetery, that members of Halau Mele and Halau Hula o Manoa paid their respects to those who died. The townsfolk turned out, too, grateful knowing that decades ago, soldiers came from so far away from our Pacific Islands to stand with them.
It was very moving to see all the group in the cemetery because, well, I know they participated too. Mm-hmm. And, well, it's very, I think it's very important here. And all the children participate, you know, in the cemetery you saw. Every 6th of June, they put a flower on each tomb, and I think it's important.
The town's mayor, Jacques Lulon, welcomed the Hawaii contingent, grateful to be included as part of the festival.
Pour le festival, je crois que c'est des îles, hein, ça doit être ça. Et ils nous ont fait le plaisir d'abord.
Christine Harkness, a longtime member of Halau Hula o Manoa, underscored the mayor's efforts to remind us of what it means to be allies.
He's always made a real effort to make veterans welcome and to push the message, you must not forget. And wherever was the right-wing vote getting high in Europe, he always insists that we must never let this happen again. So the people here are very conscious of what the war was about and what it did.
The mayor's cultural attaché, Emmanuel Jacques-Don Payet, tells us along the towns who care for the war dead of their allies, diplomacy is deeply regarded.
And it's very, very important for us. And to have this ceremony of the Hawaii ceremony, it's very important too, I think. And I have to ask the British Cemetery is the authorization to come here, because here you are in England. It's not our territory. And they were very happy to have this ceremony in the cemetery.
Just out of town at the U.S. cemetery where thousands of Americans are buried, there on the wall is a name of an infantryman, Private Henry Sa'aga from Hawaii. The Halau members perform a heartfelt Oli. Their presence turns heads. A French resident tells us he visits every D-Day anniversary, leaving flowers for his Hawaii friends who have ties to American soldiers buried here.
Traditionnel hawaïen pour honorer tous ceux qui reposent ici au cimetière pour apprendre plus de votre histoire.
The festival events in Normandy were a sprinkling of somber, respectful ceremonies and lighter moments, which included hula on the beach. Nothing showy, nothing splashy, just simple and sincere.
Just an old Hawaiian custom. When we say aloha to you.
And that was a nod to the Hawaii ties to Normandy as we mark the 75th anniversary of D-Day. It was part of a trip featuring the Hawaii Festival in France last year.
In the cold gray light of the 6th of June, in the year of 44, the Empire Lark sailed out from Pearl to join with thousands more, the largest fleet the world had seen. We sailed in close array and we set our course for Normandy at the dawning of the day.
That is it for today. Tomorrow, stepping back in time, we'll bring you more oral history from Hawaii's plantation shopkeepers. Tell us what you think, suggest an idea, call our talkback line. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us at Facebook at The Conversation HPR or Twitter at HI Conversation. This show and all past ones available on The Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.